Okay, so welcome back. Before I start, I just want to spend a few minutes understanding how the assignment is going. Are there problems, issues that you want to bring up that might be of broader interest? Yes. Yeah, so good question about timestamps. There's some material I'm going to present today that will be relevant, although none of this was required for the project. So you are you can make any assumptions you want. So you can actually take assume, for instance, that the clock on the server and the client are roughly synchronized. So you can just take real time, just read the value of current time and use that. Okay, that's an assumption. You could also just use not real time but logical time. You could just use a number, an integer that acts as a clock. Every time you do something, you increment it by some value and you use that. So just events are just numbered, post events are numbered 1 through n, and time t is basically any integer that you specify and you go forward. That's also acceptable. We will actually look at a notion of a logical clock, which is the latter concept, and physical clock today. If you use real time, that's perfectly okay. Generally, most of these machines would be running some clock synchronization in the background, so clocks will be roughly synchronized. So that shouldn't be an issue. Okay. Any reasonable assumption is fine. I mean, if you just use real time to do timestamps, I think that's good enough. That's the easiest thing you can do. Anything else about how is it coming along? Are people getting there, close to getting done, haven't started? Which end of the spectrum is it? Close to getting done?
Finish hopefully. The code itself, but not the tests or anything like that.
Okay. Okay. So, as I had sent an email, or as I had mentioned in an email, we are here to help. Come talk to us if you are running into issues or you are. Want to ask about some decision you have made, whether that's appropriate or not. Email is fine. Come talk to us. Vimal is going to be available much of the afternoon tomorrow. Okay, he said he's definitely around 2 to 4, but if there are lots of people, he can stay beyond. So practically all afternoon he is going to be available to answer your questions. Okay, if you want, he can come to the Ed Lab and sit there, but I presume most of you are doing your assignment on your local machines and you're just going to upload, right? So then there's no point in having him sit there to help you do something. If you want, I can have him hold office hours in the Ed Lab. That's a possibility. Okay, otherwise he's just going to do it here in his office as he does normally. Then you can come and talk to him. Okay, you can bring sample code or your laptop or a printout if you want to talk. Okay. So I'm presuming everything is on track and you will be able to submit it on time. Okay. The only thing I have not figured out is whether to make you upload your the documentation you're supposed to turn in on Spark or whether to leave it on the Ed Lab in your directory. Either way is fine according to me, but if you want, I can make a Spark thing and you can upload it there as well. Is there a preference? Sorry?
I think
okay. Everybody knows how to use those machines, right? Even though you may not be using it for your project, how to upload thing there and just leave it in your directory. Is that fine? Okay. So again, come and ask questions. There are a few days left. So yes, you have something.
We're testing the program. Should we just test it with multiple processes on our local machine, which we actually run on multiple
computers? How do you do the testing? For this project, it is okay to run it locally.
Multiple processes
locally. As we start sort of scaling it up in the next assignment, you will have to make this distributed. It may be a better idea to use more than one machine to do your testing, but for now, it's fine to just use one. Okay? Okay, so another sort of logistic issue is at some point we need a midterm exam. Okay. Typically, I would say we would have it in early November. Okay, that is the typical thing. I am actually toying with the idea of actually having it a little later, meaning mid-November rather than early November, for a couple of reasons. So I just want to ask people, do you have preference if it's later is better or earlier is better, or nobody has any opinions one way or another?
So later.
Procrastinate. Okay, so if it is later, I'm not going to put more material. Otherwise, there won't be anything in. There will be only 2 weeks of material for the final. Clearly, I wouldn't do that. So, independent of when it is held, I think the material from September and October will be on the midterm, and the later material will sort of focus on the final. So that you don't have to assume there will be more material. That's not the issue. So issue is when to hold it.
Yeah, so I thought for later.
Okay, people like to procrastinate. So I will go with later, and later would probably mean mid-November. And the only reason I say that is I am going to be traveling on one of the class days. So rather than missing a class, if I can actually have the midterm on that day, that helps us achieve two objectives. So I will send out a date. Yeah, and it's sometime around 15th or 14th or so. I will actually check exactly when to have it. Okay. It will typically, as is the case, it will be an evening exam. Okay. So, not held in class. It will be held from 6 to 8 or some 6 to 7:30 if it's a 90-minute thing. Okay. Somewhere in this building. Okay. So, I'll send an announcement. I just wanted to get a quick input from you. Okay. So, assume that it will be mid-November, which also means incidentally that your second assignment will be done before that, because we have three programming assignments. If I wait until mid-November to give the second one, we won't have time for the third one. So I will hand out in that case the next assignment immediately. So you can finish that assignment and then still have enough time for the test. Yeah, that's how we are going to structure it. Okay, so let's come back to the lecture. Last time we were talking about naming. I introduced the notion of domain name system as an example of a distributed naming system. Okay, the main point was, in a large distributed system, the naming component of the system itself can be fairly large and itself has to scale, okay, to the size of the distributed system. So an example of DNS was it needs to scale to all the machines in the internet, because it provides a service for every machine that's out there. So that system itself is distributed into multiple layers. It's a hierarchical system. We looked at what the layers mean, looked at several examples of DNS queries, what DNS records look like, and so on. So what I'm going to do today is just finish that discussion. There was one part that we didn't cover, which was directory access protocols. Okay, so we'll look at directory access protocols X.500 and spend a little bit of time talking about LDAP, and then we are going to go on to the next topic. Okay, that's going today. We will basically talk about physical clock and clock synchronization. So that's the next chapter of the book. Okay. So are there questions on DNS before I move on here? Okay. You should know what DNS means in terms of what kind of service it provides, okay, and how the structure there resembles what any large distributed naming system should look like as well. Okay. So let's look at directory services. So what is a directory service and how is it different from naming systems we have looked at thus far? So if you look at DNS as a very specific example, it allows you to do exactly one kind of lookup. You specify a name of a machine and it returns the IP address of the machine. Okay. This is sort of a simple lookup mechanism. Okay. So it's like a table lookup mechanism. You specify one field, it gives you the other field. Okay. Now you can generalize this notion as using this notion of a directory service and say you don't restrict what type of entries or what type of keys you specify for the lookup. Let us make it more flexible. Okay. So, in particular, you allow clients to look up entities based on attributes rather than a single field. Okay. So, a simple example of this may be, let's assume you have yellow pages. Okay. Not a physical book yellow page, but let's assume that thing is online. So rather than saying, I want to look up person X and what is his phone number, which is what a typical telephone directory would look like, what the Yellow Pages allows you to do is multiple attribute lookup. You can say, I want to look for a plumber. Okay? I'm not specifying the name of the plumber, you're saying a category. Then what this directory service, it would return all the entries for a plumber that it has. You can say, I want a plumber in Amherst. Okay, and then you now specify two attributes, a location and a category. And it returns you certain entries. And from that entry, then you can say, I want to look up the phone number or the address of this person, and you get something. Okay. So essentially now this begins to look more like a database where you have multiple fields, a record with multiple fields, and you can specify any field and do lookups, or some combination of fields and do lookups on those. Okay. That's basically how we are generalized. So DNS was very specific. It had only two fields, name and IP address, and you could specify one, get the other. Here a record can have multiple fields called attributes, can specify any one of them or any subset of them, and it returns all matching records. Okay. So that's what a directory service does. Okay. So clearly it generalizes what DNS does. Now, X.500 was one of the first systems that tried to generalize this concept of naming to do multiple attribute lookups. Okay. It's a standard, OSI standard, but it's a very complex standard. They tried to basically make it very flexible so it could be used for any type of lookups, any type of scenario and so on. And because of that complexity, very few real systems actually implemented the whole X.500 protocol. This was a lookup protocol. So you could design a system that implemented that protocol, had that interface, and then it would be called an X.500 directory. But because it was more complicated than it needed to be, what ended up happening was people started implementing subsets of these things, saying, here is what I need from this X.500 spec for my naming system, and I only implement this subset. Okay. And one popular subset was called Lightweight Directory Access Protocol, okay, or LDAP. Okay. The main simplification it did was it basically allowed you to do lookups on strings instead of using what are called OSI encoding. So think of, so what X.500 did is it specified its own query language. Okay. So you could make queries only using that query language. In DNS, there is no real query language. You are providing a string, which is the name of a machine, and it returns your number, which is the IP address of the machine. Okay, so it's a string-based lookup. X.500 actually specified a whole query language, so you had to generate a query saying, look up this field equal to this, and then it would return some result. Okay. LDAP simplified that and went back to saying, you have the same table structure, but you know, you can specify arbitrary strings, and I'll just do string match and return record. Okay. So that was the main difference between what a full-fledged X.500 directory service does and what LDAP does. Okay. So much simpler in terms of, there's no query language. Say, this field, this string, return all matching attributes, matching records. So that's what it does. Now, LDAP is basically a very popular system. There are many, many implementations of LDAP, and there are several here that are shown. So, the Active Directory service that any Windows system supports is an LDAP-based implementation. Okay. Novell Directory service does the same thing. It's now called Novell Groupware. There's this iPlanet Directory service, which I think is no longer commercially available. There's an open source implementation of this called Open LDAP. So pretty much any Unix flavor that you see today, Linux, Solaris, Mac OS X, they use this directory service. Okay, so username, passwords, names of printers, all of this information is stored in a directory service on your machine, and that is basically an Open LDAP based implementation. Okay. And there are many others. So the UMass People Finder, if you go to the UMass web page, you see this People Finder thing. That's a web interface to the UMass LDAP system. Okay, that's a UMass directory. The whole phone book, department information, email, all of that is in an LDAP system. It essentially allows you to do lookups. As you can imagine there, you can specify a department, you can specify a people's name. There are various ways to do that lookup. Okay. So it's a widely used directory service for variety of internet based applications or services. It's application level protocol. It's used based on TCP. Okay. And the interesting thing here is that it is basically a distributed naming service. Just as DNS is a distributed naming service, so is LDAP. So you can have master directory servers and slave servers. So you can have some number of masters, each storing a subset of your records. And there could be slave replicas that basically replicate this information, and you can do lookups at any one of them. They have a synchronization protocol which says if you update any record, add a record, delete a record, modify a record, there's a protocol that the masters and the slave use to synchronize their tables or their data. Yeah, so that any lookup anywhere returns the same information. Okay. So all of that is built into LDAP. Okay. There could be access privileges in there which say certain users can only access this type of information but not other kinds. So all of this can be implemented using LDAP. Okay. Any comments, questions? Okay. Just as an example, if you want to know more about this, go to the OIT webpage and look for implementing directories, sort of doing directory lookups on your desktop. Okay, so for Linux, Mac, Windows, I believe they put instructions that says here is how you can take a typical client, okay, that supports LDAP lookups, connect it to the LDAP database, and then you can just look up people's phone numbers as a simple example. Okay. Good question. So here is, so just to give you a very quick so here is directory services. So I have two here, the UMass and there's a departmental one. So I can just specify any string. If I need to be on the network. Okay. Okay. So here it returns me phone number, email address, my room number. This is a local departmental LDAP server. Okay, so it is showing me how to do lookup. You have to configure that LDAP server in your system. So here is the UMass LDAP server, for instance. So this is how you, once you do that, it will allow you to do lookups. This is the, this is a departmental one as well. Okay, just very quick example of how you can do. And this is just doing LDAP lookups for people's information. You can do the same thing for username, password. Okay. You can have a network directory service. Any machine that can talk to it, you just go there, enter your username, password, it contacts that directory service saying, this is the username, this is the password, does it match? If it's yes, then you are allowed to log in, for example. That's another very popular use of directory services. Okay. Is this clear? Okay, so here is just a sample record of LDAP namespace. So it is basically the records have various kinds of attributes. So here is one record. That's the record itself. That shows the country, that shows where, what's the location, it shows the organization, the department, then what's the name of the service, and it can give IP address. So this is how an LDAP service would do equivalent of local DNS lookup or host lookups. So internally, if you are doing some lookups, you can basically say, I have this name, what's the IP address, you can actually use this service to do lookups. Globally, you can use DNS. So you can set up your system to do lookups in multiple places. Okay, so again, what should be clear from this is that this is a hierarchical namespace. Okay, this is the tree that you have constructed as a country level record, I mean, attribute, there's an institution, there's a department, there are machines within the department. Okay, so the namespace is hierarchical, just as you had a file name spaces are hierarchical, DNS is hierarchical. Same is true of LDAP system. Okay, you have hierarchical naming. And all of these things refer to the fields. Okay, OU is organizational unit, this organization, C means country. So these fields are predefined. Okay, you have to populate it based on what schema you want for your lookup system. Okay, so that's basically directory services, and now we will move on to the next topic, and this is basically, I guess, chapter 6 of the book. Okay. So there are several important sub topics we are going to cover in this chapter. This is going to be a good third of the course or so, because what you will see is these are what we call canonical problems in distributed system. The same problems keep coming up again and again in variety of contexts. So we basically pull them out and study them in the abstract, and then you can apply them to any system. Okay, that's the notion of timing and timestamp that you are facing, or sort of you have to address in your programming assignment. Okay, we look at that problem today in the context of time ordering and clock synchronization. Okay, just to give you an example of how this problem arises in practice in a variety of scenarios. Okay, so today we will focus on only the first bullet. Okay, but there are several lectures we are going to spend on these things. So we'll do leader election, we'll do mutual exclusion, which includes distributed locking. We'll do distributed transaction. We will spend a little bit of time, maybe not a whole lot, on deadlock detection. Okay? All in a distributed system. All of these things you can also do in a centralized system. You can have locks on a centralized system, do localized transactions as any database system does. Same is true of deadlock detection. But here our scenario is always we have a collection of machines. There are processes running on those machines. They want to do one of these things. Okay, they want to elect a leader. They want to implement a distributed synchronization mechanism. They want to do transactions. How do you do it? Okay, what protocols would you use to do it? Okay, so today we'll start with synchronization. Okay, so let's try to understand what is this problem of synchronization. So if you take a centralized machine, okay, just a single machine, not a distributed system, okay, time on that machine is very clear. Okay, you just the machine has a notion of a real-time clock that keeps ticking. That the time that this clock maintains is somehow assumed to correspond to real time, okay, and any process can read that time, okay, and use that time for whatever it wants to do. Okay. And all processes running on that machine have a common clock, which is the most important thing. Any application, any process, if it wants to know the time, it goes to that clock, and that clock alone, there is only one. So all of them have a consistent notion of time. If process 1 reads the clock and it says it's 11:30, and process 2 reads that reads the clock later and says 11:31, you know that thing, that 11:30, that time actually was after the reading of the previous clock value. So all of that is clear. So the time is not ambiguous. Okay? The notion of time is very clear. Okay? So in a distributed system, however, each node, because this is a collection of machines, each node has its own clock, its own real-time clock. Okay? And these clock values may not all match. Okay? The clocks may not be synchronized. So if process 1 reads the clock value on machine 1 and it says it's noon, and process 2 reads the clock value on machine 2 and it says it's 12:01. Okay? Unless we know something about the relative values of these clocks, we cannot say that reading occurred after the previous one. We cannot compare those times. Okay? Unless we know something about the clocks themselves. The clocks are out of sync, one clock is behind the other. Okay? Although this one is actually getting time 12:01 and this one is getting noon, that may actually have occurred before this. Okay, because that clock is fast, for instance. Okay? So, and this can cause problems, a variety of problems. Here is one problem that you can sort of experience when you use machines to compile programs automatically. Okay? So, what this is showing is what will happen if you store your files, okay, on a centralized server. Let's say you store your files on an NFS server, your home directory is on a central volume, okay, on a different server, and you have a workstation that mounts that volume and you are doing local software development. Okay. So you basically go and you update some file, okay, and you hit save, okay, and then the file gets saved on the server. Okay. And then later on, okay, you want to recompile your program because you made modifications to the file. And if you use a program like make to do this, what make does is it automatically tries to find out which files have changed since the last time you compiled it, and it compiles those files and only those files rather than all of the files in your system or in your application. Now, because you are doing the file is stored on one machine and is being compiled on the other, okay, the clocks on the two machines are independent. Okay? The clock on the server is different from the clock on your workstation. Okay, each of them has their independent clock. So here is what could happen. Okay, you do something in your editor, okay, and you hit save. So you, and then the storage server or the NFS server will store a copy of that file on the disk, and it will attach the local time on that machine as the time of last modification. Okay, because every file has a time of last modification. And that is using the clock on the NFS server. Okay. And now you run make on your local workstation. Okay. What is make going to do? It's going to look at when you last compiled the file. Okay, so you, let's say it's a C file. So you have a .c and a .o. Okay, .o was a file that was created by the compiler last time you compiled it. Okay. So you have so only if the .c file is newer than the .o will it recompile. It says this file has changed, this is the time this file was created, this is the time this file was created, this time is later than that time, so the file must have changed. Okay, because this is the last modified time of this, the source, this is the last modified time of the binary, the source is newer than the binary, recompile. Okay, that's how make works. Okay. Now if the clocks are not synchronized, okay, let's say you just recently compiled it, you went back to the file, you edited it, you saved it again, but if the clock on the server is slower than the clock on the local machine, then what is going to happen is the file that you modified will have an older timestamp on it than the file that was created by the compiler locally. Okay. So in other words, make will not know, because clocks are not synchronized, that the file has actually changed when it has. Because all it is doing is comparing timestamps. So your source file that you modified has an older timestamp than the binary file that you make your compiler created. This could happen either if the storage server is slow or if your machine's clock is fast. Okay. So in other words, this program is not going to do what you expect it to do. Okay. The reason this is happening is because your two machines and their clocks are not synchronized. If your file was stored locally, this wouldn't be a problem. That's what I meant by time is not is unambiguous in centralized system, because both your editor and your make program are using the same clock, which is the local clock, because all files are, so as soon as you save it, it gets the clock value from the real-time clock. And if the compiler was using the same clock and the compiler ran previously, clearly that .o file will have a smaller timestamp, an older timestamp. So this won't be a problem. But in a distributed file, if you use a distributed file system, you will have a problem. Yes, for sure.
If you just want to know if it changed, can you just use an MD5 sum and make instead of a timestamp?
Yes. So there are ways to not use timestamps to do this, which is to actually look at the content of the file and figure out if the file has changed. You could clearly do that. Okay? But make does not do that. It is using timestamps. Okay? And you will see this problem. Okay? Same issue can arise in your programming assignment. Right? So assume that your client and your server, you are doing a post, okay, you send a request off, this database server will use the local timestamp on its machine to assign a timestamp and you post a record. Later on, the client can do a query saying send me all the updates since time t. Okay. If the clock on your client is not synchronized with the clock on the server, this time t that you have specified will not match up with what time you expect the server has. Okay. So you may miss a few records, because if your time is faster or slower, then some records may be missed, or you may get more records than you need. Okay. Again, if clocks are synchronized, this is not a problem. It only happens if the clocks are not synchronized. Okay. So just to give you an example of the same exact same issue in the context of your programming assignment. Okay. Now for your programming assignment, as I said, you can assume that clocks are synchronized even if they may not be, and not worry about this problem. Okay, but in real systems, you have to worry about this problem. Okay. So now, what is the solution to this problem? Okay. One solution, as was pointed out, change the application. Don't make it depend on timestamps. But timestamps are really fundamental. There are many, many applications that use this notion of time to figure out. In this case, what they're effectively trying to figure out is which event happened before which other event. Is this file newer or older? That's what you want to find out. And you use the notion of time to figure that out. You are comparing time values to say which one is newer. Okay. So there is no getting around it. You may be able to change make and get around this problem, but you may have other applications like your programming assignment. So this is a common problem. You want a common solution to this problem. Okay. So what could you do?
You could do time of the client request instead of time of the file creation, because the client request will always come on your clock, which is obviously synchronized with yourself.
Okay. So you could use time of the client request versus server, but in an arbitrary distributed system, you may have n nodes. Right, so which one do you rely on? Whose clock is the most distinguished clock in the system? You cannot get around this problem. So the typical solution to this problem is, rather than changing the application or changing the protocol, let us do what the application expects. The application effectively is expecting that these two clocks are synchronized. They are the same. Okay. If it's time t in real time, then both these clocks also tell you the same time. Okay. So for this, we will look at this class of algorithms called clock synchronization algorithms. So these algorithms run in the background and they actually adjust the clocks on these machines so that they basically remain in sync. Okay? If they remain in sync, any application that assumes that the clock remain in sync will function correctly. Okay? So that's the reason to understand clock synchronization at all. Okay? Whenever you have any distributed application that uses the notion of time to make any decisions, okay? And there are multiple entities in the system that run on independent machine, then you have to ensure that their clocks are synchronized. Otherwise, your application will malfunction. Okay, correctness of the application is going to be an issue. Okay. Now, all this said, it is important to realize that you may use clock synchronization algorithms, but you will never be able to perfectly synchronize clocks. Okay. Even clock synchronization algorithms have errors. Okay. So each algorithm that we will see will specify a tolerance. So like the typical ones like NTP algorithms that most of these machines implement, they can introduce errors of 5, 10, maybe up to a few tens of milliseconds. Okay? So they will synchronize the clocks, but only within that error tolerance. Okay? So if your application requires a resolution that is finer than that, then your application will still malfunction. It's not like the clock is synchronized and they are perfectly in sync. So that is never going to be the case. There is still going to be some error. And then you have to ensure that your clock synchronization algorithm does not have an error that is greater than what your application needs. Okay, if it is greater, then your application will still not work. Okay. So before we study clock synchronization algorithm, we should try to understand what a clock needs. Okay, so what are physical clocks? What do they do? Now, you all know what a clock does. It's telling you what the time of the day is. Okay? And here are some examples of how clocks work. Okay? So the most accurate clocks you have today are atomic clocks. Okay? They basically use atomic oscillators to actually keep track of time. Okay? So you say every time this atomic oscillator oscillates 10 to the power 13 times, then you assume that the clock ticks by 1 second. Okay, so you define how many oscillations equal 1 second and you count that and you keep ticking. Okay? And because they are very accurate, that's the standard that typically is used to tell what the time is. Okay? So those are atomic clocks, but not everyone actually has atomic clocks. What we have in practice are clocks that are much less accurate. Mechanical watches, they may lose by up to a minute a day. Okay? You may have a quartz watch. Okay? Those are much more accurate, but they may still lose a few seconds a month. Okay. So quartz clocks use crystal oscillators. Okay. Those are accurate, but not as accurate as atomic clocks. Okay. So computers also use these crystal oscillators. So they are accurate to one part in a million. Okay. So what this is saying is most clocks that you use in practice are much less accurate than what you really need to tell time accurately. So in other words, most clocks have what's called clock drift. Okay, the clock drifts from the real notion of time. Okay, over a period of hours, days, weeks, you will lose some time. You will be faster by a few seconds or slower by a few seconds, depending on whether the clock is faster or slower than real time. Okay? So the issue of clock synchronization is directly related to drift. Okay? What clock synchronization algorithms do is they characterize or quantify drift and correct for it. Yeah, every once in a while. Okay. So that's basically what clocks do, and all of the clocks are essentially tracking this notion of a solar day, okay, which is defined as its moon when the sun is right above you. Okay, that's basically how that's the astronomical notion of time. Okay. And then there is this whole notion of coordinated universal time and time zones and whatnot. So these are internationally agreed standard on what is the time for a particular region in the world. Okay? and how is that offset with some other region. Okay, so you know that Eastern time is 4 hours behind, five hours behind what's called Universal time, which at one point used to be called Greenwich Mean Time. Okay, this was time in basically Great Britain. Okay, now this is referred to as UTC or Universal time. Okay, the way you actually get hold of UTC is basically there are mechanisms to broadcast this time to anyone, and if you listen to this broadcast, then you know what the time is. Okay, so for instance, in the United States, you have an atomic clock that is stationed in Boulder, Colorado. Okay, and there's a radio frequency on which this clock is actually broadcasting its time. Okay, it's like an FM, I think it's shortwave, some radio frequency. It's like a radio channel, except that on this channel you only hear time. So if you listen on to this channel, and this channel has coverage over the entire US, terrestrial US, you can actually tell what the time is, because this is broadcasting time. Every second it's sort of saying this is the time, this is the time. So you listen on to this channel and say this is what the time is, and you set your clock to that time, and then you're synchronized with an atomic clock. Okay? This is how you would do this. Okay? Most cell towers also broadcast time. Okay, so your cell phone automatically synchronizes with a cell tower. Cell towers themselves synchronize with an atomic clock. Okay, so most of these, so there are various ways to broadcast what the time is. So if you listen on to some channel that's broadcasting time, you can synchronize with your channel. Okay, there are also satellites that broadcast UTC time. So if you have a receiver, GPS receivers, actually get that time from satellite. We'll see that in today's class. Okay. The point being that you need to synchronize your clock, which is not going to be accurate, which is going to drift, with some master that really knows what the time is. That master is some atomic clock somewhere. Okay. So that's broadcasting time, and clocks themselves synchronize with it. Okay. This is how computers synchronize as well. Okay. So there will be some machine somewhere that's synchronizing with the atomic clock, and that machine will then locally broadcast time. We assume that that machine knows that what the time is. Other machines will synchronize with that master. Okay? So that's basically the gist of clock synchronization. Okay? You need a master, and you synchronize with a master. Okay? But to understand more of the details, we should now characterize what a clock does, what a clock drift is, and so on. Okay? So here is basically a figure which shows on the x-axis universal time, and on the y-axis the time on any physical clock. Okay? And this line here, the solid line, shows you how a perfect clock is going to advance with respect to atomic time. Okay? So what this is line is slope of 1. Okay? So what that says is every time atomic clock ticks by 1 second, this clock also increments by 1 second. Okay? So basically the time is incrementing exactly at the same rate as an atomic clock. That's an ideal clock. Okay. Real clocks will never track this line. Okay. So real clocks may actually track either a line that's shown here or here. Okay. If you are actually advancing slower than the atomic clock, okay, you have what's called a slow clock. In this case, your slope is going to be less than 1. Okay. What that says is every time the atomic clock ticks by 1 second, you tick by somewhat less than 1 second. Okay. Which means every time this ticks by n, you may tick by n minus 1. So you are actually lagging behind an atomic clock. Your clock is faster when your slope is greater than 1. Okay? You are ticking faster than an atomic clock. Okay? So this is basically characterizing drift. So this gap is referred to as a drift from the atomic clock. Okay? This is the time by which you are faster or slower. Okay? So we will assume that any physical clock has a maximum drift rate rho. Okay? This is the maximum time you are going to lose. Okay, per unit time, this is the number of seconds you will be faster or slower every one day, for example. That tells you the drift with respect to real time. Okay? And we will assume that it is bounded. For most clocks, there is some error tolerance. Okay? So your clock, if you say it's off by a few seconds, that's your tolerance. Okay? That's the maximum time by which you expect the clock to be off. Okay? So now, given any two clocks, okay, that you have, and if each clock drifts by at most rho, okay, these two clocks themselves may be off by at most 2 rho. Okay, because in the worst case, one clock will be faster, one clock will be slower. Okay. So the maximum gap in the time between these two clocks will be 2 rho. Okay, because, is that clear? So in other words, if you any time delta t, in any period delta t, the maximum gap between these two clocks is going to be 2 rho times delta t, because this is the rate at which you are off as the time period. So in 1 hour, you will be 2 rho times 1 hour. In 1 day, it will be 2 rho times a day. And that's the maximum gap you expect to see between any two clocks. Okay? Now, if you want your clocks to be synchronized within, let's say, delta millisecond, you want a property that says any two clocks in my distributed system cannot be off by more than delta. Okay, this is the bound on which you have imposed on any two clocks in the system. And what this says is that you need to resynchronize every delta over 2 rho. You can specify delta. That's the accuracy you want for your synchronization. Saying delta needs to be 1 second. Two clocks cannot be off by more than 1 second. Then this says if they are drifting by 2 rho apart, then they need to be resynchronized every delta or 2 rho seconds. So every delta or 2 rho, each clock needs to be resynchronized with the atomic clock. And then they start drifting and then you resynchronize and they come back in sync and so on. Is this clear? Any questions on this? So what? This is just a concept. This is not an algorithm. This is just saying what is the basis for any time synchronization algorithm. And the two most important points are clocks are going to drift. And depending on how much you need, what's the error on tolerance on which you are willing to tolerate, okay, that delta, you need to resynchronize. The more they drift, the more frequently you have to resynchronize. That's the point. Okay, the less they drift, the less frequently you have to resynchronize. And the period is actually determined by delta as well as the drift rate, rho. Yes.
If your drift rate is constant, can you just multiply by the inverse of that constant to get to a perfect time? So if you know you always take 2 seconds for every one, just multiply by half and you have a perfect clock.
Yes. So that's a good question. Question is, if the drift rate is constant, can you self-compensate? If you know that my clock is 2 seconds faster or 2 seconds slower, then why not every 1 hour I just take corrective action? You could do that if you could characterize your drift rate. But as is often the case, you cannot actually characterize. The drift rate for a clock is not constant. Okay, it actually depends on the temperature. For instance, because I said it's a crystal oscillator, okay, that oscillator will oscillate slightly faster if it's warmer or colder. Okay. So if this is a clock on your machine, if you're doing computation, machine heats up, clock may actually tick slightly faster or slower than if it is cold. So the drift rate will itself vary depending on environmental conditions, okay, humidity, temperature, so it can keep varying. So you don't know, that's the first thing. Okay. And the same type of clock will actually yield different drift rates on different machines. This also depends on how it is manufactured. Because it's a crystal, depending on slight imperfection in the crystal, the same two crystals, I mean the same clock with the exact same crystal, will have slightly different drift rate. Okay, so you could never actually characterize it as a constant drift rate. But if you could do it, that would be a fine solution. The point is you cannot, typically. Okay? Okay, so here is our most trivial algorithm for synchronization. Okay, this is called Christian's algorithm. Okay, here we'll assume that there is a distinguished machine in your distributed system called a time server. Okay, this server is somehow itself synchronized with a atomic clock. Okay, it has what's called a UTC receiver. So you have attached a receiver that can somehow listen on to something that is being broadcast by an atomic clock. And then this machine is resynchronizing itself using the receiver. So the clock on this machine is assumed to be accurate. Okay. There are many ways to actually implement, sort of plug in a UTC receiver to machine. That we will not talk about here. Okay. You can just buy a device that you plug into a USB drive, run a piece of software, and this USB device will pull the UTC time, and you just read it and keep resetting your clock. And that's one way to do it. Okay. But we'll assume that time server knows what the time is. So then our problem is we have to resynchronize each machine with that time server. And so what each machine does, machine P requests time from every server every delta over 2 rho. So you specify delta, okay, that's configuration parameter. 2 rho is basically, rho is also characterized for a given type of clock. Okay, so based on the manufacturer may specify that if you buy this clock, I guarantee that even in the worst case, regardless of heat, humidity, worst case it won't lose more than a minute a day. Okay. This is based on their empirical measurement. Okay. So I guarantee it's at least going to be that accurate. It may be much better than that, but it will never be worse. So you use that worst case value that's specified by the manufacturer, and then delta is what you specify, and then this machine P is going to go to the time server and every delta or 2 row seconds and ask for the time. Okay. So here is what happens. This is when the machine asks for the time. Okay. Your pack, and this is going to be going over this. This request goes over a network. Okay. So you send a request or a message to the time server. Time server receives that request. It will take some finite time to process it. Okay. This is the point in which it is reading its own clock, because it's read the clock as part of the request, constructed a response and sent it back. Okay. So you request for the time from the time server here. You get back a response here. Okay. The response is it's time T on my clock. Okay. Now you could blindly set your clock to time T, but it's clearly not accurate. Okay. Because you are setting your time at this point in time, and this is real time, and you are setting your clock to T, but that's a time in the past. Some time has elapsed between the time the server read the clock, constructed a message, sent it to you over a network. Okay. Even though this is coming to you, maybe coming to you at speed of light, this is still finite time. Okay. So you are going to be off by this much. Okay. And you want to compensate even for that error. Okay. So how would you do that? Okay. Ideally, you should set your time to T plus T reply. That's the real time on this server at this point in time. Okay. The real time is not T at this instance, it's T plus T reply. So you not only have to ask for time at the time server, you also have to compensate for the delay that is incurred in making the request and getting the response. Okay. So the most simplest thing you can do is you can assume, make a simplifying assumption, that T request, which is the time it took for your thing to go there, and T reply are identical. Okay. So what you do is you send a request for the time here and you note your local time. You then see when the response came back, and you know this time now. Okay, this is using a local log. So you sent a request to the time server at noon, okay, and you got back a response 5 seconds later. So you know this is 5 seconds. And if you assume these two are equal, then you know that this is 2.5 seconds. So you take the value that was returned by the time server, you add that 2.5 seconds, and that's what you set your local for. Okay, that's what is said here. Use T request plus T reply over 2 as an estimate of T reply. This is just an estimate. Okay, it's not accurate. Okay, this is why there is going to be an error in your clock. That's where the clock synchronization error also creeps in. Yes.
Not only may not be equal, but your clock might be slower or fast. So even though you think it might be 5 seconds, it might actually be 6 seconds or.
Right. True. Your clock may not be accurate, but the point is this is typically a fairly small value. This is in the order of hundreds of milliseconds that it takes you to get back a response. The inaccuracy of your clock in that such a small period is not as important. So you will assume that this is going to be accurate reasonably. Then all you have to do is estimate. The bigger issue though is not that there is an error in the clock, but this time will keep varying. Right? This depends on, number one, it depends on network conditions. Right? This is not a single hop over a network. It could be multiple hops. You may be going over a router. You may be going through switches. Okay? So that, and that's what latency that it takes you to go to the time server and come back may depend on the load on the network. Okay? And then it may be variable, as is shown here, that the request took longer to go and was faster to come. So this is not exactly equal. Okay? So all of those are going to introduce inaccuracies. Yeah, so one thing you could do is make multiple measurements of T request plus T reply and use a mean of those measurements, saying on an average it takes so much time for me to get a response, so I'll use that mean value to compensate the time I'm getting from the server and add that mean to that. Okay, so you could make multi series of measurements to characterize what's the load on the network, how it's changing and so on. Okay. Each of these steps will make your clock synchronization algorithm more accurate. Okay, but this is the basic algorithm. All of the others that we will study except one actually is some derivative of this. Okay, is that clear? Okay, so now this one assumes that there is a distinguished machine called a time server. Okay? And so it's in some sense a centralized synchronization algorithm. All machines go to this one machine, get their time and set their time. Okay. Now we look at a completely distributed algorithm called the Berkeley algorithm that does not use a time server at all. Okay. all this is algorithm is doing is it's keeping all the clocks in the system synchronized with one another. Okay? Whether these clocks are collectively synchronized with real time is not material. Okay? So if you just want the clocks to be synchronized, but you don't care whether that has any correspondence to real time, then Berkeley algorithm is fine. It's a fully distributed algorithm. It does not use a time server at all. Okay? You just synchronize clocks with respect to one another. So here what happens is, there is a master and there is a slave. Okay? The master can be elected. Okay? If one master goes down, you can elect another one, and so on. So we'll assume that the group of machines collectively make one machine the leader or the master. Okay? So what the master does is it periodically polls all the slaves for their time. It gets all of their time. It computes the average of those time, sends those back. Okay? And all of the machines then reset their clocks to this mean time. And I'll show you how that works. Communication delays are compensated as before. Okay? All the latency of going over the network, we know how to figure out, so we'll not assume that is an issue here. Okay? So here's the algorithm shown in picture. Okay? So here is a network of three machines. That is your master. These two are slaves. Their clocks are off. This one shows it's 3 o'clock. This says 3:25. That says 2:50. Okay. So this broadcasts a message to every machine saying what's your local time. Okay. So it sends a message to itself. Okay. Or rather it sends its time and says what's the local time. It's 3 o'clock. What's the time on your machine? Okay. So each machine then takes the difference between the time that was broadcast and their local time and send the difference back. So this one says I'm 10 minutes behind. Okay, so you send a minus 10. This one says I'm 25 minutes ahead of your time. And you send a message to yourself saying I'm synchronized. Okay, you send a 0 to yourself. Okay? And you just take these three values and you compute the average. Okay, so the average is 15 over 3. Okay, which is 5. So basically it says that the average time in the system is 3:05. Okay. So you basically tell everyone adjust your clocks by this much. So you tell this machine saying increment it by 15 minutes, you say decrement yours by 20, and you send a message to yourself increment by 5. So at the end of this they are all at 3:05. Okay. So what you have done are two things. Okay, you have basically computed the average time in the system. Okay, so you are saying some clocks are fast, some clocks are slow, let's take their average. Okay. And we'll make all clocks tick at the average rate of clock ticks in the system. Okay. So you find the average and then you reset all the clocks to the average. Now as I pointed out, there is no real time server in the system. Okay. What's happening to real time is independent of this algorithm. Okay. So clocks may actually show a time that is different from real time. In particular, if one clock is very fast, okay, it may skew all the other clocks because you're taking the mean. Let's say one clock is 1,000 times faster than all the other clocks. Because it's the mean, everybody will actually move at a rate that's faster than real time. Okay. Only if your clocks are uniformly distributed around real time, some are faster, some are slower, but the average clock actually ticks more or less at the same rate as real time, will this clock advance at the same rate. But there's no reason that should be the case. Okay. And we don't care either. All we want is a property that the clocks be synchronized. Whether they have to tell the real time is not a property that you require. If you require that, then you need a time server. Okay? But in most cases, you just want to compare two clock values. Okay? Saying, does this happen before this or after? Okay? What was real time is not material. Okay, in your assignment, you send T, you just need all the posts that have happened after T. That's all you care about. So you don't really care about real time in that case. You just need a consistent way of ordering these events. Okay? So for this is sufficient. Okay, question.
So there's no real distributed way to do it because you always have to have one server that handles all
yes.
the average. You can't synchronize otherwise, right?
No. So I'll talk about, so this is, so question, is there a distributed way? I'll show you how to make this fully distributed on the next slide. This is the basic concept of how do you do synchronization without a time server. This still has a master. Okay. Master can be re-elected if one master fails and so on. But you could just make this distributed, and the way you do this is what are called resync intervals. So in this case what happens is each machine periodically broadcasts its time to everyone else. Okay. So then what a machine does is it listens for all the broadcasts from all of the other machines. It locally computes the average and it resets its clock to the average. There's no reason to just do this at the master. If everyone broadcasts their time to everyone else, you know what everyone else's clock is, you can resync, compute the average locally and do the same thing. So you can implement this Berkeley algorithm in a fully decentralized manner by broadcasting time. So you have these intervals which say this is the resync interval. You broadcast time at the start of each interval. You basically collect all broadcasts that arrive in a small short period S. You compute the average. You can then throw away the fastest or the lowest values if you believe some clocks are way off, so I don't want to take that into account when I compute the average. And then I just compute an average, reset my clock. Same algorithm, just implemented in a distributed way, without a master. Okay, is that clear? So today, most machines use this notion of, there's this thing called RDate, which you can run and that will go to a time server and get a time clock value and then reset it. You could do that, or you could use a more sophisticated protocol like network time protocol or NTP. We'll come to NTP in just a few moments. So this uses similar algorithms to the Christian's algorithm, except that the techniques it uses to compensate for network delays and so on are more sophisticated. Okay, but basic concept is the same. It yields accuracies of between 1 and 50 milliseconds. Okay. So if you use NTP, it's guaranteed that you are no more than 1 to 50 milliseconds off with respect to the time server. Now if your application needs more accuracy than that, then this NTP is not sufficient. But for most practical applications, that's reasonable. If you are 50 milliseconds off, that is okay. Because most of the time you only keep time in seconds, not in milliseconds. Okay, but if milliseconds or nanoseconds are important, then this will not work. Okay, question there.
This averaging algorithm, does it not care about the time it takes to send messages?
Okay, question is, does the averaging algorithm not care about the time? You do. You do the same thing. Communication delays are compensated the same way. Yeah. So you have to do that. I just assume that here the communication delays are zero just for simplicity. But you have to do exactly the same thing. Yeah, otherwise.
It doesn't know when it was sent. How does it know what the time was?
You can do queries, right? So this knows when it sent this message, it knows when the response came back, which is the same thing as T request and T reply. So this is the master is sending a poll, is getting back a response, so he knows this time.
But in the distributed one, there is
no... In the distributed one, you will not have this. So you will have to compensate for network delays in a different way, because you are just pushing out values. You could, of course, poll. I could send a broadcast saying, send me your times. Somebody else could also send a broadcast. So you act as your own time server, and you just collect all the values and you do that. You could do that as well. But if you just broadcast periodically and listen, then you don't. So now we are going to talk about global positioning systems and GPS. So what GPS does is it actually does two things. It allows you to synchronize a clock, and it also allows you to determine the location of the clock. Location of where this unit is. And it basically uses this principle of localization. Rather than using this, I will show some examples in just a moment. So let me draw a picture here. So the way GPS works is it uses the notion of beacons, which are essentially satellites. So there are satellites that are at known positions in the sky that are broadcasting their time. Okay, and these satellites are assumed to be synchronized with an atomic clock. Okay. So let's assume that you have a GPS receiver here. Okay. The coordinates of the GPS receiver are not known. And the problem is you want to compute where this GPS receiver is. And the time on this GPS receiver may also be off with respect to atomic time. So the GPS protocol is going to do two things. It is going to find the coordinate of this receiver as well as the time, or synchronize the time on this receiver with respect to this atomic clock. And it works using very simple thing called triangulation. So here is a satellite. Okay, the location of the satellite is known to you. Okay, we'll call it X1, Y1, Z1. This one's location is X2, Y2, Z2, and so on. And all these clocks are synchronized on the satellite. Are broadcasting Y3, Z3. So their clocks are synchronized, their locations are known. This one's clock is not synchronized, location is unknown. Okay? So a simple thing that you could do is this is basically broadcasting time periodically. Okay? So this receiver has to listen to the satellite broadcast. Okay? These are the beacons that are coming to you. Okay? So let's assume that this distance, which is unknown, is D. Okay? Let's assume that there is a time value that was broadcast saying T, and this was received here at T now. Okay, so this satellite broadcast a time value, okay, and then this receiver received it at T now, which is a local value of the time there. Okay. So now you can use this simple thing to compute what the coordinates are. So here is the first thing. So this distance D is the Euclidean distance between these two coordinates. Okay. So that basically is D square root of x minus x1 square simple Euclidean geometry. That's the distance between those two points. Okay. D is unknown because xyz is unknown, but that's the distance. Okay. Now also the other thing we are going to use is that this beacon that was sent here was sent at the speed of light. Okay, this is basically a broadcasting and it's received here. So the point is this distance is also the time it takes for light to travel from here to here, or any electromagnetic wave from that takes to travel from here to here. Okay. So if C is the speed of light, that distance can also be characterized as T now minus T. Okay. Is this clear? This is only true if T now and T are, these two clocks are synchronized, okay, which they are not. So if these two clocks are synchronized, then this distance, okay, is basically the speed of light times the time you sent it and the time it was received, the time it took for light to traverse from there to there. Okay. Since the clock are not synchronized, there is a drift there that you have to add. So let's assume you compensate for this drift with this parameter rho, which is also unknown. Okay. So, and these two values are the same. These are just two different ways to compute D. Okay, so you can basically say, put this as the left term and say C times this. So that's the equation we are going to get. Okay. Now, what is known in this equation? Speed of light, known. T now, known. Okay, that's the time at which you receive, so you can make a note of that. T is known. That could be included in the it is included in the broadcast, saying this is the current time, that's what you are sending. Okay? T is known. This is unknown. Okay? X, unknown. X1 is known. Okay? So X, Y and Z are unknown. X1, Y1, Z1 are known. Okay? So there are four unknowns in this equation. Okay, delta is unknown, x, y, z are unknown. So four unknown, one equation. Okay. So assume that now there are other satellites that are doing exactly the same thing, and this clock can listen to multiple satellites. Okay. So you get the same equation for each of the satellites. Okay. And each of those equations has the same four unknowns. Okay. Because the location of the satellite is always known. So the point here is if you had actually four satellites that you could listen to, okay, your four equations and four unknowns. Okay. So you can solve for those four equations and four unknowns and actually derive the value of delta x, y and z. Is that clear? So if you have the same number of equations as unknowns, then you can actually compute those unknowns. If you have fewer equations than unknowns, you cannot compute it. So you need to listen to at least have four satellites you can lock into before you can compute it. This is why you are, if you have ever used a GPS receiver, you start it up, it starts listening for satellites. And when it locks onto at least four or more, then it can compute its own location. That's because without at least four, you don't know what your location is, because there are more unknowns than no equations. Okay, yes, question.
Is the delta the same unknown in all the satellites?
Delta is not the same. Oh, yes, it is the same. That's a good question. Question is delta the same unknown in all the satellites? All the satellites are synchronized with atomic clock. So it's assumed that these are all synchronized. So they are assumed to be all perfectly aligned. So this is always going to be misaligned by delta with respect to all of those flows. If that was not true, then we would have a different delta. That's a very good point. Right? But because we assume that the satellites are perfectly synchronized with the atomic clock, you will have the same delta drift with respect to all of those clocks, but they are all synchronized. That's why you have the same delta. Okay? So, if you solve this, then you, as I said, you will get two things. You will be able to synchronize yourself with respect to an atomic clock, okay, because you have figured out delta. So, you take your clock and you compensate it by delta, now you are synchronized with respect to atomic clock, and you found your coordinates. So, you know now the location of the clock and you know what time to set for that clock. So, you did two things in the same. So, that's what any GPS receiver would do. Okay, once it figures out its coordinate, it will have a map and it will figure out where it's on the map and display you the map and whatnot. But that's orthogonal. What's happening in there really is this. Is that clear? Okay. Now, in practice, you may have the versions of GPS. This one is assuming that you only want to compute X, Y, Z. But some GPS receivers also give you altitude from sea level. Okay, because if the clock is, I mean, if you are not at sea level, then you have one more unknown, which is your own altitude. This is the coordinates, but then how much off are you from sea level. So you can get your altitude as well. Okay. That requires more satellites because there's one more unknown you have introduced in the picture. Okay. But typically we don't worry about that. So this is the basic concept, is only know your coordinates in X, Y, Z, three dimensional space and time. Yes.
Well, isn't, can you get the altitude from X, Y, Z, since X, Y, Z is relative to the anchor positions, and if you know the position of Earth relative to the satellite, you can figure out what that actually projects to in altitude, latitude, and longitude, right?
Yes, that's true. You could use X, Y, Z to figure that out, but I think there is an additional, if you know where you are on the position of the Earth, probably true. But I think you can also compute that just with respect to another satellite and compute that as an additional unknown, or you have to know where you are on the Earth. And so that's, you have to either have that knowledge or you use one more satellite to figure that. So one of the two things you can do. Okay. Is that clear? Any questions on this? Okay. So the whole point here is you have actually done clock synchronization in the process. You are doing some other things as well. Okay. And look at the fact that we could actually compensate for the delay. Here this is just speed of light. Okay. Rather than delay to go over a network, this latency was speed of light. It was well defined for us. We didn't have to do this T request, T reply thing. Okay. Because this is just a plain broadcast that's coming over the air. You just know, use this value to compensate for the speed of light, exactly what you would have done in the any other clock synchronization algorithm. Okay. So the point is, GPS can also be used to do clock synchronization, and that's the thing you use there. So here is one last thing I want to say about clock synchronization, and then I'm going to stop. So there are other protocols that people have used in wireless networks, for instance, or sensor networks to do clock synchronization. This is somewhat similar to the Berkeley algorithm in a more distributed setting. So there is something called a reference broadcast sync. Okay? So there's a time server that keeps sending reference broadcast. Okay? So these are beacons that are being sent. Any client can listen to those reference broadcasts and synchronize itself with respect to the time server. Okay? So here is a reference broadcast. Okay? So this is the time that you are going to broadcast, time t. This is the time it took to send out the message, and this is the time at machines B and C when they received the message. Okay. Now the problem here is you want B and C to synchronize themselves, okay, relatively, using this broadcast. That's what you really want to do. Okay. So what you can then do is actually take the value that was broadcast and some estimates of the message preparation time, the transmission time, and so on. Okay. And then you can compute what is your relative drift with respect to one another, and then compensate for that. Okay. So effectively what you are doing is B computes its drift with respect to A, C is computing its drift with respect to A, and then B and C can exchange these values and say, this is how much we are off with respect to one another. Okay. So very simple example is, one clock says I am faster by 5 minutes, with respect to a master server. Another clock says I'm slower by 3 minutes. Okay? And then these two clocks can exchange these values, and then they know what the relative drift is, and the relative is 8 minutes. Okay? So now if they want to communicate, then they only need to adjust their timestamp by this value of 8 minutes. Yeah, that's the point that you, so rather than synchronizing yourself with something, you just compute a drift with respect to something. You keep that drift and you exchange that drift values, and you can then relatively compensate with respect to one another. Okay? This is what many algorithms actually use in the context of wireless network, okay, and specifically in sensor networks. Okay. So, before I stop, there's one more thing. This is very quickly network time protocol. As I said, this is very similar to Christian's algorithm. Okay? So, there's a time server, you have T request, you have T reply, you have to compute this, you see the time that was sent, and you have to compensate for it. Okay? And what is done here is you have 8 pairs of delays. Okay? So you made 8 measurements from A to B, and you use some mean or some algorithm that says based on these 8 measurements of network transmission times, I will compensate for whatever time I'm receiving from the server. Okay? And you use this to make it more accurate. So I'm not going to go into how you use this 8 measurements, but that's basically what is done. Okay? The other thing that is important in NTP is it is hierarchical. Okay? So you can have some server somewhere, then you can have NTP, some other server that synchronize with respect to that server. Then you can have clients that synchronize with respect to that, and so on. So again, the issue here is if you have just one clock and there are a large number of machines that synchronize with that clock, there is going to be a load on this machine. Okay? So you have made this synchronization protocol itself hierarchical or more distributed. Okay? There are some number of root masters, you synchronize with some of the roots, and then your local time NTP server synchronizes with respect to root, your local machine synchronizes with your NTP server, and so on and so forth. So you can do that to do synchronization. Okay, so there are machines in our environment, ntp.cs.umass.edu or ntp.umass.edu that are synchronizing with some other master somewhere, and you can synchronize with that. Okay? Because you can synchronize with some other master yourself, but typically if you do this hierarchically, then load on each of these machines is going to be reasonable, okay, rather than overloading a machine. That's one issue. The other thing that is also important, which I actually didn't mention, is in NTP, your clock can never go backwards. Okay, so if you are running faster than real time, okay, all of this while we assume that you can just take this clock value and move it back so it resynchronizes. Okay, but moving clock backward can be detrimental to many applications. Okay, think of a local program. Okay, it reads time T. Okay, you are doing measurements. So let's take your programming assignment. You are asked to measure response times, okay, of your request. So how do you do this? You read the time at the beginning of a request, you read the time at the end of a request, and say this request took this much time. Okay? So let's say you reach time T. Okay? And while the request was being processed, your machine synchronized itself with a time server, found that clock was faster, okay, and moved the clock back. Okay? Then you read the time in which your request finished. Okay? And that time turns out to be less than the time your request started. Now you have negative response time. Okay? That doesn't work. Most applications don't assume that clock goes backward. This is fundamentally all applications assume clock goes forward. Okay? So the clock actually gets reset and moves back, many applications go haywire. Because they are assuming fundamentally time will never go back. Okay? So one additional thing that you need in some clock synchronization protocol is actually even though you may be faster, you don't want clock to actually move back. If you move back, then many applications are going to start malfunctioning. So how do you resolve this issue?
Yes,
so you have to stop. You could do stop, but that's also not good. If you read real two times and they are identical, you expected that some time has elapsed, that will also be a problem. Yes. You could set it when you boot, that's true. But this is assuming the machine is just running and NTP is running.
You could slow down the clock time.
Yeah. So you could, basically the only thing you do is if your clock runs faster, you make it tick at a slower rate. So that real time catches up with you rather than you moving back and resynchronizing yourself. Okay. So what NTP or many algorithms do is, rather than actually moving back, they detect that your clock is running faster, and you artificially make this clock tick at a slower rate so that real time catches up with you, and then you start ticking at the same rate again. And the only reason to do this is you cannot have clocks that go backwards, and most applications are assuming that you will always tick or move, time will going to move forward. And then if you don't do that, you are in trouble. So you need some control to ensure that clock can actually tick faster. So you can, if you can control this clock value. So what you can do, for instance, is if your clock says every 100 time this crystal oscillates, I tick by 1. And you detect that clock is actually ticking faster, you slow it down. Okay? You say wait for 101 oscillations to make the clock tick by 1 second. So your clock actually waits a little longer and actually advances slower than real time. At some point, real time catches up with you and then you reset. You can do things like this. Okay? To do compensation in software. Okay, so that's where we will stop. But remember that that's an important point, okay, which we sort of glossed over in our whole discussion. We don't want the clock to actually, you can always jump forward, but you can never jump, shouldn't typically jump backwards, okay, without causing problems. So we'll stop here. Next time we'll talk about this notion of a logical clock. Okay, today was all physical clocks.